This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. Washington Irving is probably best known to most of us today for his classic stories, Rip Van Winkle and The Legend of Sleepy Hollow. But there is so much more to Irving. He served as an ambassador to Spain. He wrote the first significant biographies of Christopher Columbus and George Washington. He also helped popularize St. Nicholas in 19th century America. In this portion of the program, we're going to take a look at the life of one of America's first celebrities, Washington Irving. Our guest this afternoon is historian Andrew Burstein. He is the author of a new biography of Irving, The Original Knickerbocker, The Life of Washington Irving. Listeners, I invite you to join our conversation this afternoon with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Our guest, Andrew Burstein, is the author of six books, including The Passions of Andrew Jackson and Jefferson's Secrets, Death and Desire at Monticello. His new book, The Original Knickerbocker, The Life of Washington Irving, is published by Basic Books. A native of New York, Burstein is a professor of history at the University of Tulsa. 333-9455-800-222-9455. Those are the numbers if you'd like to join the conversation this afternoon. Andrew Burstein, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, hi, Celeste. Thank you for inviting me on.
Oh, my pleasure. What a story.
Well, no one had written a biography of Washington Irving since 1935, and I'm actually the first professional historian ever to do a biography of Irving because most everyone who wrote about him were literary scholars, and they were interested in his role as a writer, and I'm probably more interested in his role as a cultural icon. And you alluded to some of this in the introduction about how he contributed to American culture, whether it was his contribution to the Christmas holiday, the Americanization of Christmas, which we usually attribute to Charles Dickens. In fact, Dickens worshipped at the feet of Irving, who came up with the idea when Dickens was just a child. And the other thing that Americans don't remember anymore, but which made Irving renowned in the 19th century, was the first English language biography of Christopher Columbus that in fact, went through 175 editions, which is an incredible number.
And it was popular both here and in Europe.
Yes. Irving spent 17 years living in Europe and traveling around Europe and writing about Europe, and from 1815 to 1832. And interestingly, there were a good number of Americans who thought that he had sold out, that he, although he was born in New York, a Manhattanite, and retired to Sunnyside, his little dream castle on the banks of the Hudson River, those 17 years he spent in Europe were years in which Americans were developing a very nationalistic spirit, a sense of America's moral importance in the world, and a lot of people thought that Irving had become a European-style historian and had kind of abandoned his American sensibility.
Yeah, and he also wrote a multi-volume biography of George Washington. How do these books read today? How do these biographies read today? Do they stand?
Yeah, great question. Some of them are still fun and enjoyable to read. Others, such as the Washington biography, it's for our taste today, it's too hagiographic. It just it glorifies Washington as the founding genius, as a man who was a superior character. I mean, he doesn't invoke the chopping down the cherry tree legend, but it is kind of romantic and overblown. The Columbus biography is a little bit more approachable, but it too has been superseded by the more sensitive works done in the late 20th century, around the time of the 500th anniversary of 1492, which demonstrate that Columbus wasn't a George Washington-type figure, which Irving makes him, but in fact was very comfortable with slavery and had a hand in the decimation of the native populations.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Irving in a 19th-century style is what we would call politically conservative, cautious, and a bit too romantic.
Yeah. Now, the book that first made him, A History of New York, also known as Knickerbocker's History of New York, published in 1809, it made him a celebrity.
Yeah.
It's a satirical work, a mock history.
Yeah.
What stories does it tell about New York?
It tells the story of 17th century New York when it was New Amsterdam, and Irving is telling the story of the Dutch origins of the city, his hometown. But it's really, and everyone would read between the lines and understood this, it was really a portrait of America in 1809. It was a portrait of Jeffersonian America. And that's how Irving was able to carry off his political satire. And this was really the height of his genius. Before he became a genial storyteller, he was a sharp, witted political satirist in Knickerbocker's History. What he did with that book, and really it's the only book of his that we would even possibly call a novel. He mostly wrote short stories, and of course Rip Van Winkle, Legend of Sleepy Hollow, he became famous for those two particular stories. But in Knickerbocker's History, he took on the politics of the day, and he satirized, for example, President Jefferson, whom he called an overeducated micromanager. You know, Jefferson was all philosophy and no practical plans, that he was an inventor who had invented carts that go before the horse and, you know, things of that nature. So there was no hail to the chief for Irving. He wasn't praising the president, but rather suggesting that it's the forgotten people in history, the ones who do the least, who are to be celebrated for their honesty or honor, and that the so-called honorable, the great, are actually quite modest in their talents and just have a high opinion of themselves. So it's that kind of political satire.
It sounds like a great read today.
I think so, and in fact I've been talking to the publisher about reissuing it, maybe an illustrated edition, so that's still a possibility.
Yeah. Well, talk with us. It sounds like a lot of fun. Is that why it became a hit with readers, or was there more to it than that?
With Knickerbocker's History in particular?
Yeah.
It was so funny. I'm trying to think. It was kind of like a Woody Allen approach. He was inventing early America and inventing a nostalgia for a history that people didn't know about. So he made history fun. And this was a time when history, you know, was very serious, very grave, and it taught moral lessons. And he kind of turned that on its head. So the same kind of people who would go see a movie today that, that you know, causes an uproar, makes you laugh, that's kind of the way in this world where reading was so much a part of everyone's everyday world. The best way of communicating that kind of jolly good time. And so, you know, this is where Irving first introduces St. Nicholas, the jolly mm-hmm. Santa Claus. And it's in that kind of spirit that he wrote, that this was all about fun. It was just like Santa Claus. It was about delivering good times to a people who know hardships, who are you know, see early and frequent death in their families, and he was trying to deliver good cheer, just like Santa Claus.
Yeah. One of the things that you say about this book, Knickerbocker's History, is this. It was Washington Irving's opening salvo in his war against accepted wisdom and moral authority. And you also say this novel, quote, made room for America on the world stage. Talk about that.
Yeah. He was showing the provinciality of America. He was saying, okay, Americans, let's not take ourselves as seriously as we do. And ironically, that that message was part of a literary genius that caused people in England to pay attention to this new young writer. He was only 26 years old, and Americans started to look up to him as an inventive genius, an inventive writer, and that is how the word Knickerbocker actually became associated with a friendly name for New Yorkers generally. Knickerbockers were the literary crowd that surrounded Irving, and they were satirists, but they were also sentimentalists like Irving. They were theater critics, they were social critics, newspaper essayists, and what the Knickerbockers all had in common, and it was a New York trait and then an American trait, was to say that we as a people exhibit a superior kind of wit. And so America, room was made for America on the world stage by saying that Americans are not just country bumpkins. Mm. They actually have an edge about them, and Irving was the first to represent that.
Yeah, we can laugh at ourselves, but we're up-and-comers.
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, historian Andrew Burstein. His latest book is The Original Knickerbocker, The Life of Washington Irving. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Well, now when I think of the New York Knicks, I'll think of Washington Irving.
Right. The New York Knicks became a professional basketball team in 1946, I believe. And it was precisely 100 years earlier that Irving's made-up mock historian, Diedrich Knickerbocker, gave his name to the first professional baseball team. The New York Knickerbockers came into being in 1846, so 100 years before the New York Knicks. So that name Knickerbocker has really had a long life.
Now, when did the literary community known as the Knickerbockers take shape?
That's really, they begin really in the 1820s, or at least that name is associated with this crowd of, as I said, essayists and theater critics and sentimental satirists like Irving and his boyhood friend, James Kirk Paulding, another one of these people who was once heralded on both sides of the ocean and is now pretty much lost to our historic memory. But, you know, what they did was, I mean, Irving started out by in Knickerbocker's history, romanticizing not only the Olaf the Dreamer, the Dutch supposed founder of New Amsterdam, who got his inspiration from the Dutch patron Saint Nicholas, but the Indian name Manahatta, Irving played with, had fun with. He was always playing with names, and Knickerbocker is another. The pseudonym that he used in writing the sketchbook, where we're introduced to Rip Van Winkle and Sleepy Hollow, was Jeffrey Crayon, and so. Some people knew Irving in later years, Uncle Jeffrey. So he was kind of a mainstay of popular culture, and always, you know, introducing something new that would catch on, like Knickerbocker caught on, or Rip Van Winkle caught on. It's the story of losing time without losing the past. It's how memory works, that memory is fragile and memory is powerful, and that the past just seems to disappear, but if we go into our imaginations, we can bring it back, and somehow it does, you know, Rip falls asleep for 20 years, but he wakes up and he's unhurt, and he becomes a celebrity in the village. Again, one of these Huckleberry Finn type good-for-nothings who, an anti-hero, a character who represents something about the American character and who helps us to revisit our history as a people and find some spirit, some sense of belonging. And he does it with fun. He does it with this pure, pastoral, dreamlike past. Irving is the first American escapist. Everybody else took the world quite seriously. And, you know, part of my job as a historian is to read old newspapers. When I read the newspapers, I see, you know, a very dangerous time, a politically high-toned and difficult time. People have a lot on their minds, and lots of people are going broke.
And the Republic is very young.
It's young. It's fragile. And Irving gives us. Gave his generation, his generation are the sons and daughters of the American revolutionaries. So they idealized that their parents' generation, the founding generation, as a generation that they could really never hope to equal in achievement. So what he gave them instead was a way of approaching history that it wasn't just about envying those who came before. It was a way of having fun with them. It was a way of using the past to forget our own problems. And that kind of escapism is what literature has continued to be. And Irving was really the first American to engage with history and engage with culture in that way.
Yeah. Under the name Jonathan Oldstyle, he wrote pieces for a publication called The Morning Chronicle. What kind of pieces were those?
Mm-hmm. That was the very first published essays of Washington Irving. He was about 20 years old. The Morning Chronicle was a newspaper edited by his older brother, Peter Irving. And Peter was born in 1776. The Morning Chronicle, like most newspapers at that time, was a political newspaper. It had been set in motion by the supporters of Aaron Burr, who ran for vice president under Jefferson and then was abandoned by the Jefferson administration, ran for governor in New York. And Peter Irving, most of the Irving brothers, they were a large family, and Washington was the baby of the family. They were Burrites, and in the Morning Chronicle, as Jonathan Oldstyle, Washington Irving offered a little humorous commentary on the New York theater scene, and it was probably the only writing in that newspaper that was not highly political or partisan. He talked about the theater as a place where the wealthy and the ragged mingle, and there were people in the balcony throwing rotten apples at the people in the orchestra section, and you know. So he kind of told the story of the theater, which wasn't just about what was happening on stage, but also what was happening in the audience.
Yeah, and these writings for the Morning Chronicle showed great promise. I mean, they showed him to have a talent for.
Yes, they did. And in fact, some of the later newspaper writers who would applaud the release of a new Irving volume in the 1820s or 1830s would sometimes refer back to him as, you know, oh, you remember Jonathan Oldstyle. Well, this is what he's become. So Irving was a bit embarrassed by his early writings. He thought they were juvenile and did not wish to republish them in his collected works. But nevertheless, there were a lot of people who remembered the early Irving fondly.
Yeah. Well, he was so young.
Yeah. He was first American to actually earn his living as an author. And he was trained in the law when he was 17, 18 years old, around the turn of the 19th century. But he knew that it wasn't for him. That, you know, I mean, when he was growing up, he knew that all he wanted to do was write. But since no one had earned their living as a writer, he really expected that he was probably going to endure his life then they were poorly paid lawyers, and that he wouldn't be a very good one, but it was the only way that he might move into a higher social stratum. And so he was probably more surprised than anyone when his early writings, there was a buzz about them, and he became a national phenomenon. He, as early as 1809, or maybe 1810, just after the appearance of Knickerbocker's History, he was invited to the White House, the President's House, it was known then, and got to know James and Dolly Madison, and he was already a celebrity.
And he was all of, what, 25?
He was 26, 27 when he first went to the White House, and by the end of his life, by the end of his career, he was on familiar terms with 8 United States presidents, and even though he tried to steer away from politics, he was, you couldn't help but be caught up in it. It was kind of like Benjamin Franklin, who began as a scientist and ended his career as a diplomat, and Irving, who started as a satirist and ended up his career when he was... let's see, in his 60s, he spent several years in Spain as America's ambassador. Mm-hmm. He had been, prior to that, an unofficial advisor to President Andrew Jackson. So there was we don't see this anymore, but there was an odd connection between literary celebrity and political office. He was asked to serve as mayor of New York, and he refused. This is in the 1830s, when he had just come back from Europe. And he was asked to be Martin Van Buren's Secretary of the Navy, which he refused. And there's, I'm sure I can't reproduce it, but there was in the book, a great quote where he's writing to an old friend of his, one of his oldest boyhood friends, who's urging him to run for Congress, as a number of people were. And Irving said, "Run for Congress for political office? I should have to run mad first."
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, historian Andrew Burstein, author of the original Knickerbocker, The Life of Washington Irving. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with your questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, anywhere else toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now, a listener in Champaign, on line one. Hi.
Hi. I'm wondering if you have run across the name of Rebecca Gratz in connection with Washington Irving.
Yes, I have.
Okay.
I write a little bit about Rebecca in my book. She was a young Jewish woman from Philadelphia.
Correct.
Who was a close personal friend of Irving when he was pretty much on the theater scene.
Mm-hmm.
So it's early in his career.
Mm-hmm.
And it is said, and I don't know if this is for sure, but literary critics who have written about Irving over the decades have claimed that Rebecca was the model for Sir Walter Scott's...
Rebecca in Ivanhoe.
That's right, in Ivanhoe.
There is a portrait of Rebecca in my family, and we have traced that tale back and believe that it is true. As a matter of fact, there is still, or was until fairly recently, a survivor of the Gratz family, whom we were able to meet and talk with. While she was Gratz by marriage, she pretty well said that, yes, that was the version of it that was in their family also. Rebecca had a kind of a salon in literary and artistic folk in Philadelphia, and Irving was one of the more or less regulars, although of course he wasn't in Philadelphia all the time. And the story which this Mrs. Gratz more or less verified for us was that Irving had gotten acquainted with Sir Walter Scott in England, and that he brought him, when Scott was making a tour of the United States, to Rebecca's salon, and that Scott was smitten with her.
I don't think that Sir Walter Scott ever came to the United States.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And
well, that's interesting.
Irving became, he was Irving's patron in England, really. I mean, Irving had been living in England in the mid-18 teens for a couple of years, and trying to find his way back into literary celebrity after having left New York. And it was Walter Scott who whispered in the ear of John Murray II, the premier publisher in Great Britain, that he should pay attention to Irving's talent. And this was how Irving achieved his transoceanic celebrity. So he owed a lot to Walter Scott, visited Walter Scott in Scotland, and spent several days with the family. And around the time he was writing The Sketchbook and Rip Van Winkle, and I think that it was around this time, well, it was around this time that that Scott was writing Ivanhoe, and so it was most likely around this time that Irving told him about Rebecca Gratz of Philadelphia.
And possibly might even have showed him a miniature of her, because there were some floating around at that time, apparently.
Well,
she was beautiful.
Yeah, I don't mean to belabor this, but let me just suggest, if you haven't seen it, there is a book, a biography of Rebecca Gratz by Roland Osterweiss.
I know the one called The Grandees by Stephen Birnbaum, but
no,
well,
tell
me again.
This is written in the 1930s, and it's an excellent book.
Okay, I will look that up. The other thing is that my husband and I were both scholars of Spanish, and we are quite familiar with the really excellent translations that Irving made of a number of the old Spanish ballads. And, of course, that kind of translation is one of the most difficult there is. Poetry to poetry is really hard to do. And he did an excellent job.
Oh, well, that's good to hear. Anything that's going to recover Irving's name and legacy, I'm all in favor of. As I said, it was 70 years between the last substantial Irving biography and mine, and the guy who wrote the biography in 1935, although he was a professor of English at Yale, he seemed to make it his life's design to trash Washington Irving, to say
right.
that he was
a lightweight,
exactly.
Yeah. Not worthy of Hawthorne and those people, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I disagree, and as I say, the Spanish translations are really quite beautiful.
Well, yeah, and let me take this opportunity to recommend Irving's Tales of the Alhambra, which I'm sure you know, but which are still very popular in Spanish in Spain, and Irving's name probably. It resonates better in Spain these days than it does in the United States.
I agree with that. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, and I'm so glad that there is a new biography.
Well, thanks for calling.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thanks for the call. Other calls are invited, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our guest this afternoon, Andrew Burstein, author of the original Knickerbocker, The Life of Washington Irving. It is our guest's sixth book. It's published by Basic Books. Well, speaking of Washington Irving as a translator of Spanish, it leads me to ask, what kind of education did Washington and his siblings receive?
several of his brothers were educated at Columbia College, Columbia University, which was one of the, well, and still is one of the premier schools in the United States. For some reason, he did not attend Columbia, which means that he didn't, you know, in order to attend, you had to achieve a really scholarly level of Greek and Latin. And Washington Irving wasn't really interested in that kind of erudition. So his older brothers went to Columbia. His eldest brother, William, became a congressman. He was in the House of Representatives for several years after the War of 1812 and was a supporter of President James Madison. His brother Peter, I mentioned earlier, was a newspaper editor, although Peter wasn't tough enough to withstand the nature of partisan politics, and he gave up the newspaper business, preceded his younger brother to England, where he set up a business, the brother's business, called P&E Irving, an import-export company. But he failed in business, too. So Peter Irving, who was, like Washington, a lifelong bachelor, kind of followed his famous younger brother around and lived off of him. Let's see now. There was also John or Jack Irving, who did become a lawyer and eventually a judge and kept offices on Wall Street. So, they were... The Irvings became a very well-known family in the New York area.
Yeah, and they were very close to one another, apparently.
Yes, they were. It was an extremely close family. We know less about the sisters. Washington Irving had two elder sisters that he wrote a considerable number of letters to, and unfortunately we have almost none, well, very few of the letters from the girls to him. But he was close to both his brothers and his sisters.
Yeah. Tell us about the woman that he loved, Matilda. And unfortunately, she died at a young age.
Matilda died at the age of 16, and her beau, Washington, was working as a law clerk or understudy for Matilda's father, who had been the Attorney General of New York State. Again, he was, you know, traveling in good circles, even though he and his brothers grew up rather modestly. He was very close to the Hoffman family, spent a lot of time there. And when Matilda was very young, 13, 14, he taught her drawing and music, told her stories. And he was terribly hurt when she died, and he went off to live in seclusion for a while. But this is also the time when he wrote Knickerbocker's History. So he was getting over mm-hmm. the mourning period, getting over her death, by writing satire and finding his sense of humor. Now, for many, many years, writers had described Irving's, this tragedy in his life, as one which caused him never to marry, because the one true love he had died, and it was a trauma that he couldn't get over. But you know, that's one of those 19th century romantic legends that takes us away from looking at Irving as a lifelong bachelor. And, you know, so we should explore his sexuality, because it's very much a part of his literature. Many, many of his stories deal with the lives of lifelong bachelors, and he celebrates them. He celebrates bachelorhood. What we know as homosexuality was not understood or discussed at that time. And I'm not suggesting that Irving was gay, but we have to look at their culture very differently from modern American culture. And so the life of the bachelor was generally understood to be someone who had either been spurned by the woman he loved, and he would wear a locket with a lock of her hair in there, for the, you know, but could never marry again. And so any man who chose to be a lifelong bachelor usually had a story attached to him. Irving's story was the Matilda story. With some of his characters in his short stories, they were, you know, similarly tragic or tragicomic. But these were always people who occupied an important place in their communities. The bachelor became sort of like a bachelor uncle, and there was nothing strange, nothing untoward, nothing fearful about it. You know, there wasn't the same kind of potential threat attached to the bachelor. But the bachelor was seen as someone with a deep imagination, who indulged in reveries like Irving, who had a romantic side, but who just didn't marry.
Yeah. Irving, of course, is well known for his stories, his short stories. And, you know, thinking about this, I recall, you know, a lesson from a long time ago when... sitting in a classroom, I was told it was Edgar Allan Poe is the father of the short story, and I think maybe Washington Irving deserves a lot of credit.
Yeah, Poe admired one of Irving's volumes that's not read anymore, called Tales of a Traveler, which is a series of short stories, and they are almost all ghost stories, and they're sort of interlocked. Mm. So one story leaves you with a kind of a non-ending, and it leads to the next one, and the story really never ends. And they're ghost stories, but just like in The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, there's all this fear, but in the end, it turns out that everything is in Ichabod's imagination. And so Irving's ghost stories don't have the same fear-mongering quality that Poe's would. But Poe liked some of Irving's stuff better than other materials, but he definitely gave Irving credit for advancing the genre of the ghost story.
Yeah. Earlier you mentioned Charles Dickens was one of Washington Irving's fans, if I could put it that way. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if... Washington Irving, you know, his great character names inspired Charles Dickens in that way, because, of course, Dickens, the character of his characters are summarized in their names, and there are some wonderful names in Dickens.
Yeah, not only that, but there's one other brother I didn't tell you about, Irving's older brother, Ebenezer. Now, I am not going to go there. I'm not going to say that Irving met Ebenezer when he came to New York in 1841, and 2 years later, when he published Christmas Carol, did he like the sound of the name Ebenezer because he'd met Irving's mm-hmm. brother, and this was his businessman brother, the one who was the liaison between Washington Irving when he was in Europe and the Philadelphia and New York publishing crowd. So Ebenezer was a religious man and an astute businessman. He certainly didn't have the qualities that Dickens gives to Ebenezer Scrooge.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I think there's definitely a connection insofar as giving characters names that you can play around with that are automatically suggestive. That's very much in the 19th century literary quality.
Yeah. Before we have to wrap up, we've mentioned, or you've mentioned, Irving's travels in Europe. He traveled extensively in Europe at a couple of points in his life. He also traveled to the American frontier. Tell us about that.
Well, where I'm standing right now, on the banks of the Arkansas River, Irving encamped with U.S. Army Rangers about a mile away in 1832. Just he was he had just come back to the U.S. from the 17 years abroad, and he was going to Kentucky and Tennessee to write some sort of story, to sort of reclaim his American voice, and write some kind of story about what was then frontier. But he happened on Lake Erie to on the steamboat to run into a man by the name of Henry Ellsworth, who had recently been deputed by President Andrew Jackson to serve as kind of a lookout or a diplomat with the Indian tribes of what was then Indian territory and is now Oklahoma. And so Irving kind of hitched a ride on Ellsworth's train, and he joined the army out here at Fort Gibson in eastern Oklahoma, and traveled for 2 months in Osage and Pawnee territory, and wrote a marvelous story called or memoir called A Tour on the Prairies. In fact, I'm teaching it this semester, which is Irving's way of saying that a young man in America should go west, should find his manly spirit on the real American frontier, and this would be a much better solution than the grand tour of Europe, that this would be a way of keeping American men strong. It's a bit ironic, since Irving spent so many years and loved Europe, but he believed that young American men would mature and find their way into a place of social propriety by experiencing the Wild West. So that was the in a way the purpose of this book, but it got Irving on a kick, and for the next decade almost he wrote several more adventures about mountain men in the far west, and Astoria, the western outpost of John Jacob Astor from the period of the War of 1812, Astor being America's first millionaire. So Irving did a lot, in addition to Christmas, in addition to Christopher Columbus, in addition to Knickerbocker's history. Irving did a lot to advance the genre of the western historical romance. So once again, you know, we find Irving as playing an important role in American literary history and American political culture, something that I think it's time that Americans interested in our early Republican years recover. And Irving is a really good person through whom we can see changes in the American personality over time from, say, 1800 to 1850.
Very interesting. There we have to leave it. We're out of time. Andrew Burstein, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Andrew Burstein has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He is a professor of history at the University of Tulsa, the author of 6 books, including The Passions of Andrew Jackson and Jefferson's Secrets, Death and Desire at Monticello. His latest book, The Original Knickerbocker, The Life of Washington Irving, the publisher, Basic Books.